climate change cult and those who control it are not a conspiracy theory. They're part of an open, avowed, well-planned scheme that may read like fantasy, but in reality is absolutely deadly to every human being in the entire world.
My guest today is Brian Sussman. And Brian, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, first of all, I'm a Tom Nelson fan. Can I start there? That's why, it's funny. You see somebody for so long without meeting them and you feel like you know them. So it's interesting. I feel like I know you, Tom, and it's great to be on your program. And I have such admiration and respect for your many followers and listeners, viewers, et cetera. But my background is a broadcasting background, broadcast meteorology, and then radio talk show host for many years in San Francisco. But how I got into the weather thing is interesting, and I'm sure you're going to recognize this name. I was born and raised in East Los Angeles, but when we were in high school, we moved to the Chicago area, and I started watching Eyewitness News in Chicago, and there was this weatherman that I thought, this guy is so entertaining, and he's so knowledgeable, and man, if I could ever have a job like that, it would be cool. His name was John Coleman.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, John Coleman went on to start the Weather Channel. And John Coleman, if he were alive today, he'd be one of your viewers because we're all on the same team. But I watched John and I thought, wow, what a great job. You know, TV weatherman, meteorologist. But then I thought, okay, in Chicago city, very, very large city, there are only like 10 of these people. So what are the chances of that? But I was still interested in broadcasting and media. So I went to the University of Missouri thinking I was going to go into their journalism school, but instead went into their arts and science program and majored in radio, TV, film production. And I thought, well, I'll go into radio and maybe be a radio newsman or maybe have a radio show someday or something like that. Because I was in the School of Arts and Science, I took a lot of meteorology courses just because I was interested. I just had a personal interest in the weather. You know, like so many of your people, I'm kind of a weather geek and I'm not ashamed of that. I'm just intrigued by the weather. So I took a lot of courses in that, took a lot of courses in the journalism department as well, got out of school, and I had been working part-time at a TV station in production. And the owner of the TV station said, hey, why don't you run our newsroom and you can anchor the morning news and you could even do the weather if you'd like. So I thought, wow, this is cool. So I did those tasks and ran this newsroom and realized I hated managing people and quit that job and took another job in Reno, Nevada, where I was able to become a full-time weatherman. I was so loved the weather that I thought, man, I gotta get a degree in meteorology. I gotta do something because it's not enough. I need to know more. Got another job in the San Jose area, part of the San Francisco Bay Area market. And San Jose State University has a great meteorology school. And they emphasize forecasting, which is really fun. So I started in their master's program and just had a ball learning from some great professors and increasing my knowledge of the subject. Went from there to KDKA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and was a meteorologist there. Started working for the CBS Morning News as a fill-in weathercaster for probably 5 or 6 years, and then came to San Francisco for the CBS station where I balanced out the rest of my career. I left, and the reason why I left I'll get into, but I left in 2001 and ventured into talk radio, which was exciting. I had a 20-year career as the morning show host for KSFO in San Francisco, first conservative talk show station in the nation. And as I always used to say, isn't it interesting? We're broadcasting live from the belly of the liberal beast. So that was a lot of fun. And I made a lot of friends and made a lot of enemies. Wrote ClimateGate in 2010. A veteran meteorologist exposes the global warming scam, and then Eco-Tyranny in 2012, and then got so busy with running a morning show, which included, you know, having to start work at 3:30 in the morning, that I wasn't able to write any books until 2019 when I quit that job finally. It was just sucking the air out of me. And I said, actually, my wife said, you need to write another book. You need to do a follow-up to ClimateGate and Eco-Tyranny. And so that's when I started working on Climate Cult, which will now... It's available for pre-sale. It will actually be shipped beginning in May. The publisher is Post Hill Press. So I'm really excited. Climate Cult, exposing and defeating the war on life, liberty, and property.
I love the fact that you have Climate Cult in the name. That makes me very happy. I'm excited to read that book.
I just want to talk about how I started thinking that this might indeed be a cult. And this goes back quite a ways. This goes back to 1995. And I'm copying this from Climate Cult. There was the Leipzig Declaration. I know you're familiar with that. It was written in 1995. And it says, we believe that the dire predictions of a future warming have not been validated by the historic climate record, which appears to be dominated by natural fluctuations showing both warming and cooling. That's Leipzig, 1995. Fred Singer was the gentleman who helped put together the Leipzig Agreement. And he called me out of the blue. I didn't know him from Adam. We later became good friends. But he called me and said, listen, I know you're a member of the American Meteorological Society Board of Education, and I would really like you to consider signing the Leipzig. And I'd heard about global warming. I was a skeptic right off the bat for some reason, but I read the Leipzig Declaration and thought, okay, I'm with these guys. I will sign this declaration. And so I was honored to be a part of this. Thousands of people signed this thing. And I've got a phone call from a reporter in Orlando, Florida. And he was lauding me with all of these. I knew something was coming because he was just sucking up to me big time. Brian, I heard you won this award from the Associated Press for Best Weathercast and from the Radio and TV News Director Association for Best Weathercast. And I notice you're on the American Meteorological Society Board of Education and you won an award for the, he just went on and on. And I thought, okay, there's a sucker punch coming here somewhere. And he said, now, I just have to ask you this question. Why did you sign the Leipzig Agreement? I said, well, because I'm skeptical of human-caused global warming. He said, are you a denier? I'd never heard that term before. And suddenly he just changed so fast, and his interview turned into a lecture. He just started ripping me apart. And I remember concluding the interview, hanging up the phone in the weather office, and turning to my producer, Matt By, and saying, Matt said, who was that? And I said, well, that was the crappiest excuse for journalism I've ever heard. It was a reporter from Orlando, Florida. And this guy's ripping into me. I mean, he just tore into me for stating my opinion and signing a document. That was the first thing. The second thing that I just thought was weird was I was working for the CBS Morning News, as I mentioned, and Dan Rather was the iconic anchorman from the CBS Evening News and the his 80s, and this is in the 90s now. And Dan came to San Francisco. He was doing his broadcast from our studios, and we bumped into each other and said, hey, Brian, you know, I'd really like to start using you on a regular basis on the CBS Evening News as our West Coast weather correspondent. I see you doing the morning show occasionally. I want to use you all the time. And I think you'd be the perfect guy to tell people about global warming. And I said, well, Dan, what a great honor. I would love to help out. It'd be so exciting. I think the jury's still out on global warming, but hey, I'm available. As soon as I said, I think the jury's still out on global warming, his face just froze. And Tom, I don't even think he excused himself with any words. He just literally turned and walked away. And I don't know if this had anything to do with it, but I never worked on the CBS Morning News again, ever. I was just cut off. Now, I don't know if it had to do with that conversation. I'm not sure, but my contract was immediately cut off and that was the end. So I thought that was weird. But the next thing that happened, Al Gore was coming. He was vice president. He was coming to California. We were having a big El Nino year. Lots of rain, lots of flooding, lots of snow in the Sierra. Big El Nino year. So Al Gore had convened a El Nino summit in Santa Barbara. And he was going to link. He was going to be the first person ever to link El Nino, a naturally occurring event. It's been going on for as long as we know. He was going to tie that into global warming. And so the executive producer of our newscast came to me and said, listen, we're going to send you down. You're going to front the coverage for Al Gore coming to California for the El Nino summit. And we want you to, you know, talk to people about global warming. I said, I can't do that. I said, there's no connection to El Nino and global warming. So this started a back and forth in the newsroom. And here's how the discussion ended. He whispered in my ear, he said, Brian, your problem is you don't know which facts to leave out. And Tom, I was stunned. I'd been in broadcasting my whole life. I loved my profession. And what did he just say? You don't know what facts to leave out? Now, should it surprise anyone that when he was in college, he was the president of his student bodies, Democrats for Democrats Socialists of America Club. He was. This guy was a socialist. And he's telling me which facts to leave out. And it's very easy in this entire climate debate for people whose last name may be Mann or others to bring forth data that seems to have been highly massaged or omit data that doesn't fit with their agenda, because so many of these people don't have a moral spine. They don't have a moral backbone. For them, the end justifies the means. And so I thought, this has all the trappings of a cult. It's just amazing. And, you know, it's interesting. I'll go back to a screen share here, Tom. When you think about this and you look to see the kind of impending doom that is preached to get people into this cult, because that's what all cults share in common. There's some sort of cataclysmic problem. Maybe the problem is you're afraid of death, so you join this cult. Maybe you're afraid of your human weakness, so you join this cult to gain some kind of supernatural power. But this is how they lead people into the cult, with statements like this. This is Al Gore 2022 on Meet the Press. This is just outrageous. The climate deniers, your audience, Tom, are really in some ways similar to all of those almost 400 law enforcement officers in Uvalde, Texas, who are waiting outside an unlocked door while the children were being massacred. They heard the screams, they heard the gunshots, and nobody stepped forward. Now, can you believe that the Vice President of the United States, even knowing where he stands on this topic, would go to that extreme to try shame people and bring more people into the cult? I mean, it's just, it's atrocious. But wait, you know, there's more. If we go to this person, who's like, she has millions of followers. She is like a rock star in the minds of so many millennials, Gen Xers. Wild predictions. She said, and no one seemed to follow up on this. Our planet is going to hit disaster if we don't turn this ship around. And so it's basically like there's a scientific consensus that the lives of children are going to be very difficult. And it does lead, I think, young people to have a legitimate question, you know, is it still okay to have children? This is Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Instagram Live, 2019. Now, this kind of stuff can, and I talk about this in Climate Cult, I talk about the psychological damage that is possible with these kind of wild statements for someone who's maybe just a little troubled or having some mental health issues. These are crazy statements. Then, you know, she goes into this consensus thing, Tom, and I think I've seen people on your program talk about the 97% or 98% consensus. I wrote about that in Climate Gate. You know, that was a very small sampling of a small number of meteorologists and scientists who decided to respond to this very biased questionnaire. So that's a hoax as well. But those are some of the trappings of the cult. But the other thing that the cult provides is sin. You're a carbon sinner. You've got a problem. You're using fossil fuels and you're contributing to global warming. But wait, there's penance. You can reduce your carbon footprint. You can buy an electric vehicle that you can't afford. You can go solar. You can go vegan. You can do a number of things to improve your standing. And then on top of that, there's one more thing that they promise, and that's a utopia. They promise this future world where there's going to be social equity and there's going to be social justice. And as the World Economic Forum has said, you will own nothing and you will be happy. And for so many, Tom, that's just super, super appealing. Super appealing. I could go to another slide here just to continue this discussion. I think at the bottom of all of this are a difference, and this is why I entitled the new book Exposing and Defeating Their War on Life, Liberty, and Property. John Locke is the philosopher that the founders of America looked to when they were trying to launch the United States of America. John Locke said, and this is very important in the debate because a lot of people will say, well, yeah, it's a cult, but Now I'm telling them why it's a cult. Or they'll say, oh, it's a totally Marxist movement. But they don't understand why people say it's a Marxist movement. So I go back to primary source material to show you how, and this is shocking, I'll get to this in just a moment, Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, and some of their direct disciples were the ones who decided to use the environment, or the ecology as they called it, to hammer capitalism and to ultimately try to defeat the United States and its life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness mantra. And I'll prove this in just a moment as I take some excerpts from the book, but it's shocking. And I wrote a little bit about this in Climate Gate, as you know, Tom. But if you go to John Locke, he was a philosopher, theologian, a medical doctor, jurist, taught at Oxford, brilliant guy, had no enemies, everyone loved this guy. But he said, all humans have three natural rights. You have the right to life. You have the right to own property, which our founders called the pursuit of happiness. And you have the right to liberty. And liberty was, he said, you have a right to a government that would uphold the right to life and uphold the right to own property and uphold natural law. Well, what is natural law? It's good and evil, good versus evil. It's right versus wrong. It's lies versus truth. It's the Ten Commandments. It's do unto others as you would have them do unto yourself. He said, you have a right to a government that will uphold all of those things. And that's what's known as liberty. So we had the United States founded. The Puritans in the North really and truly believed in these natural laws. Those in the South believed in something called damn your soul, grow tobacco. And we had two Americas. One was very pure. The other was built on slavery. I mean, we can't get around that. But when it came time to deal with England, who was becoming very oppressive, they all agreed, okay, we need to hang together or we're going to hang separately. Okay, yes, we do agree with this natural law. Yes, we do agree with these natural rights. We'll deal with slavery later, and we did, with 600,000 people dying. But for right now, we're going to construct a United States of America without a king, without a queen, without a dictator, without a totalitarian ruler, without oligarchs. It's going to be government of the people, for the people, by the people. And we pulled it off. We pulled it off. Marx loathed such a thing. He was not happy about this in any way, shape, or form. So Karl Marx ends up coming up with his own solution. Marx's first goal in life, by the way, was to liquefy Christianity. That's a goal he had in college. His guiding philosophy was this: the theory of communists may be summed up in the single sentence, the abolition of private property. When you get to the climate agenda as laid out by the United Nations, when you get to the climate agenda that has now been affirmed by the World Economic Forum, their goal is the elimination of private property rights. I've got all the source documents for that. But what's interesting is if you go through the record and start to dig into the details of Marx and Friedrich Engels and his followers, Tom, it's absolutely fascinating. I talked about this in Climate Gate. I blow it out in Climate Cult. Sir Edwin Ray Lankester, he was a direct disciple of Karl Marx. He knew Marx as a youngster. He said humans are the insurgent sons of nature. He was the guy that first came up with the first environmental disaster. It was in the 1800s. People in England were living longer. People in England were having bigger families, bigger houses. They were flourishing. Why? Because they were able to get such great yields from their crops. Why? Because they were using guano. They were using bird droppings. They were using bat poop. They were using this as a fertilizer, and the yields were just incredible. It was pure, all natural, no chemicals. It was working. And Lankester saw this and he said, but they're going all over the world looking for this guano, and they're shipping it on these steamboats back to England. And look what's happening. They're having more people, and they're cutting down more trees, and they're building more houses, and they have more excrement, and they have more animals, and they need more feed for the animals. He said, this is not good. Humans are the insurgent sons of nature. It was the first ecological crisis. And Lancaster was a communist. He was raised essentially by Karl Marx. But we continue to a disciple of Edwin Ray Lancaster, Arthur Tainsley. He was the guy who invented the term ecology. He said, I'm deeply concerned with the destructive human activities of the modern world. Ecology, his term, must be applied to conditions brought about by human activity. He has a disciple named Charles Elton. Elton, another socialist. He invented something called invasion ecology. And he was the first guy to use fanciful language, which set the tempo for Rachel Carson and Paul Ehrlich and others. He said, it's not just nuclear bombs and war that threatens us. There are other sorts of explosions. And this book is about ecological explosions. So you have disciple after disciple of Marx deciding our best bet is to use ecology, use the environment as a tool to crush capitalism and give it a bad name. In fact, you have to remember, capitalism was a term created by Karl Marx. Frederick Engels was Karl Marx's writing partner. I came across this and I thought, okay, this is a gem. So this is in the new book. Listen to this. But inexorably, the time will come when the declining warmth of the sun will no longer suffice to melt the ice thrusting itself forward from the poles, when the human race crowding more and more about the equator will finally no longer find, even there, enough heat for life. Frederick Engels was the guy who started the first climate lie. It was going to be global cooling that would take down the climate, Tom. This is Frederick Engels. This is incredible. They've been running with this now for well over 100 years. Okay, but let's continue the discussion. Because if you continue this, you'll find out, look at all these lies. Look at all the lies that have come out of this. We're virtually certain that last year, virtually certain this is the warmest in 125,000 years. They throw this out there and people just believe it. You know, when you tell people, you know, we've really only been taking the temperature by satellite since 1979, they're like, what? When you tell them most of the temperature, most of the thermometers on planet Earth, as sparse as they are, have been only in place since the 1980s. They're like, what? You're kidding me. But I thought it was the warmest in 125,000 years. How do we know that? It's a lie. They completely rule out all of the history from, for example, the geological record. It's amazing how they do this. But Karl Marx said this. He said, there are elite people on this planet, and we've been born with a leap of intelligence. And because we have a leap of intelligence, we have a responsibility to rule over everybody else. And we'll do that heavy-handed if we have to, but we'll make them all equal amongst themselves. But we'll be the elite. We'll be in charge. We have a right to rule because left to themselves, they will kill one another and destroy the planet. That's Karl Marx's laws of matter in a nutshell. So you have all these other broad-minded thinkers, academicians, elitists at Davos, and all the big schools, and they all believe the same thing. They believe Marx was right. All of these lesser-minded people, you know, the rednecks with their big trucks, these people who want to have bigger houses and more stuff, shame on them. They're killing the planet. They're destroying the planet. We need to do something about that. This has been tried many times before, but now people want to try it in the United States of America. And so that's really the genesis for wanting to write this book, A Climate Cult. They're using cult-like principles and tendencies and tricks to get people in. And my goal is, with this book, to get them out by revealing the truth on things like the temperature record, which you've had so many people talk about, or CO2 becoming a pollutant, which we can get into as well. But Tom, if we could, temperature record, CO2, you want to talk about that for just a moment?
Yeah, go for it. Go ahead.
Okay, so the temperature record, I remember when I first took my deep dive as a meteorologist into the temperature record. And I was astounded by what I saw. I had a conversation with Tom Heller recently from Real Clear Science.
Yeah, Tony Heller, right? Yeah.
Tony Heller, I'm sorry. And Tony was, I did an interview with Tony, and I just love what he had to say. He was a believer. He was a believer in global warming. He had a geology background, so he had a science background, but he was also an electrical engineer working for Intel. And so, you know, electrical engineers working for Intel, it's all about precision. He thought, I'm just going to go check out the climate record for myself. I want to see this temperature thing. I want to see if it validates my feelings that there probably is human-caused global warming. He goes and does a deep dive. I mean, a much deeper dive than I did. But he does his deep dive and comes away saying, this thing is so sloppy. This climate record has been so tainted and rearranged. And there's data that's been withdrawn. And there's data that is fake that's been added to the mix. And he was just stunned and amazed. And I think there are a lot of people that would be stunned and amazed if they could really interpret the data properly. But the problem is, you know, all the influencers, all the talking heads, all the Al Gores, all the AOCs, they don't do that for their people. They just spit out this information as plain garbage. But continuing along this discussion with CO2, I mean, look at this. CO2 is now climate pollution. It's a gas essential for life, and now it's climate pollution. This is from Wired Magazine, 2022, why carbon emissions are now climate pollution. People see that, and they just believe it. But here's when CO2 first became the enemy. CO2 was always acknowledged by scientists as being beneficial for life. Scientists always knew if we had more, life would be even better because vegetation would thrive. And scientists have always known that if you get below like 180 parts per million, things are going to start dying. But in 1987, the United Nations decided to make carbon dioxide the enemy. Now, anybody who's graduated with an environmental science degree in the last 15 years knows of this book called Our Common Future. It was put together by the World Commission on Environment and Development in 1987. This is the United Nations. They herald this book in virtually every environmental science program in the United States as their gospel, Our Common Future. Here's what Our Common Future says in the very foreword. All nations, I've italicized this myself, so the italics are mine. All nations may suffer from the releases by industrialized countries of carbon dioxide and of gases that react with the ozone layer and from any future war fought with nuclear arsenals controlled by those nations. All nations will also have a role to play in securing peace, in changing trends, and in righting the international economic system that increases rather than decreases inequality and increases rather than decreases the number of poor and hungry. Do you see what they just did in two sentences? They made carbon dioxide the reason for inequality. Carbon dioxide is the reason for people being poor and hungry. They're saying that the United States in particular, which at that time was the largest producer of carbon dioxide via fossil fuels, the United States of America is the reason, because of carbon dioxide, that there are poor people in this world today. And there's great inequality because of the United States and its use of CO2 today. They were targeting the United States. This is cockamamie, but this is the way they play ball. This is the way they love to reason. Let me continue with this. John Clauser. I love how John Clauser comes into the picture when it comes to CO2. He's a part of the CO2 Coalition. Nobel Prize winner physics, 2022. He's looking at the climate models, and he's saying, these are totally artificial. They've created a totally artificial Earth. It's a totally artificial case for using a model. And that's what the IPCC does and others, a cloud-free Earth. He looks at the models, there are no clouds. He looks at the models, there's no water vapor. It's all estimated. He looks at all of this stuff. And this is what the United Nations has been banking on. I'll get to sustainable development in just a moment. Well, I guess I'll get to it right now. But the concept of sustainable development, this is what they want to do. So, Tom, they've vilified CO2 as a pollutant. The temperature record has been completely obliterated. They don't care about past warming events, whether it's the medieval warm period or other eras where we know the temperature was much warmer than today. They've eliminated all of that. They've massaged all that up. They've come up with their hockey stick. So it looks like this is the hottest weather in 125,000 years. And now they're going after a gas essential for life, saying it's a pollutant. And nobody questions this in the media, of course. They just go along with this mantra. But there's something else that the United Nations have done to vilify carbon dioxide and transform the world. And it's a term that everyone's heard of, but most people can't describe. You see, the United Nations, they're branders. They come up with terminology that's so diabolically clever. Sustainable development is one of them. You could ask 10 people randomly on the street, just do a little man on the street interview and say, oh, could you please define sustainable development? Oh, yes, it's recycling. Could you please define sustainable development? Oh, it's driving an electric vehicle, and on and on and on. Those are the fruits of sustainable development, but it's not sustainable development. Sustainable development is far more devious than that. For example, this is also from our Carbon Future 1987, where they decided CO2 would be a pollutant. They roll out the new term, sustainable development. They said the concept of sustainable development does not imply limits, not absolute limits, but limitations imposed by the present state of technology and social organization on environmental resources, and by the ability of the biosphere, it's a new term, to absorb the effects of human activities. Sustainable development requires meeting the basic needs of all and extending to all the opportunity to fulfill their aspirations for a better life. So they're saying that the biosphere cannot absorb the effects of human activities. Specifically, they're referring to CO2. So we've come up with this new thing called sustainable development. We're going to limit the amount of CO2. Developing nations like the United States that have had an entire economy based on CO2 are going to be hurt and crushed, but will be able to redistribute the wealth to all the other people of the world and fulfill their aspirations for a better life. They go on in this Our Common Future to describe redistribution. They say this is the definition. Meeting the essential needs of all requires not only a new era of economic growth for nations in which the majority are poor, but an assurance that the poor get their fair share. This is redistribution. This is the goal of this is the goal of sustainable development. This is why they vilified CO2. This is everything Marx dreamed of, redistribution. This goes right back to Karl Marx and his Communist Manifesto. This is everything he dreamed of, but they're using the environment as a hook to draw people in. Now, there's something else that takes place here, Tom, and this is social justice. Because one of the goals of sustainable development is social justice and social equity. We hear those terms a lot. And I know that, listen, I know you're in Minnesota, Tom. I have a lot of relatives in Minnesota. Some of the nicest people in the world are from that part of the country. And these are people who would give you the shirt off your back. They really believe in do unto others as you would have them do unto you. They believe in loving your neighbor as yourself. These are just good people. You find that a lot throughout America. You find some really great people in America who really prefer others and really do want to help everybody else. That's true social justice. That's true social equity. But what the climate cult has done is taken this concept and totally turned it upside down. The guy who developed the concept of social justice was a Jesuit philosopher, Luigi Taparelli. This is in the 1800s. And again, he's a thinker. So he develops this concept of social justice, basically love your neighbor as yourself. It's right out of the Bible. And then he asks a question, as philosophers do. Does the state have a right to coerce citizens to behave in a certain way? Now, the answer to his question would be no. But we've come to a place in time now where the state wants to coerce citizens to behave in a certain way in this new version of social justice. So here's the United Nations defining social justice. This is a very new concept. The new concept of social justice is new. Here's the United Nations, once again. They create the template for all of this. They define it in 2006. They say social justice is not possible without strong and coherent redistributive policies conceived and implemented by public agencies. So that means everything from higher taxes to reducing property rights to taking from those who have earned and those who have worked hard and giving it away to others who perhaps have not. This is government-induced, government-sanctioned redistribution. But it continues. Social justice will only flourish if environmental preservation, see how they do this? Environmental preservation and sustainable development constitute an integral part of growth strategies now and the future. So what are these growth strategies? It's things like, of course, net zero, which will give us an energy grid that will crush this country. The Rio Earth Summit then takes place in 1992. And President George H.W. Bush was the president at that time, and he went to Rio with all these other world leaders. It was the United Nations Conference on Environment Development. They come up with this thing called Agenda 21. Of course, we signed on to it, but it never became enacted officially in our country. But, George H.W. Bush, by all accounts, was all for it. Everybody seemed like they were all for it. And they decided they were going to do this. The nations need to create enforceable environmental laws and regulations that are based upon sound social, ecological, economic, and scientific principles. Well, you know, the word sound is in the eye of the beholder, because we've seen all the junk science that's being used now to put forward these particular principles. Also at the Earth Summit, they said this: we demand the need to control atmospheric emissions of greenhouse and other gases and substances. Clamp down on CO2. This was the very beginning of people thinking about net zero. And listen to this. Schools must encourage education and awareness-raising programs at the local, national, and sub-regional levels, and regional levels concerning energy efficiency. So now we have the schools in on this as well. And it's rather interesting, because I'll define social equity in a little bit more detail in just a moment. But in all of our schools, and I talk about this at length in Climate Cult, I take school curriculum and I start showing the reader exactly what their plan, they have expectations. I show them what the expectations are for most of the climate curricula being used in our schools today, public schools and some private schools. And the whole idea is kids aren't given a choice on what to think. They're told what to think. And they're to come out of this agenda believing without question that there is global warming, it's human caused, there is climate change, it's human caused, and our only hope is to decrease the use of carbon dioxide and radically change the way in which we live. So this came out of the United Nations in 1992, and they've been going full force with it ever since. So we've got now basically, you know, a couple generations, maybe three generations, that have been totally indoctrinated. Three generations if you go back to the first Earth Day. So that's where we are. So now let's go to this next piece of the puzzle, because this is just super important. And again, it comes from the United Nations. Social equity. They've already talked about social justice. Now in 2006, they go to social equity. Equity further demands that international cooperation be built upon processes, rules, and agreements that give preference and advantages to the weakest. Listen to this. Not based on the equal treatment of partners that are, objectively speaking, very unequal. It has nothing to do with equality. It's everything that Lenin said he was going to do, and everything that Stalin said he was going to do, and everything that every communist dictator has said they're going to do. No, the people are going to live equally. They're all going to live equally. They don't tell you how the elite are going to live. I mean, my gosh, you know, the reason why I wrote this book, Tom, is because I recently read the audio transcript for the book. So there'll be an audio book available as well. And there were actually a couple times when I was reading the audio where we had to stop tape because I just cracked up. I just started crying. And I think at the very end of the book, they kept a little of the sniveling in because they said, well, it's you. That's what you did. We'll cut out the part where you had to stop and blow your nose. But they kept it in. But this is personal for me. My grandfather came to the United States when he was 13. His family put him on a ship, and they said, he had some kind of sponsor in America. We're still not sure who the sponsor was. They sent him from Russia on a ship. They put him on a ship. He was able to make it to the United States. And it was learn English, which meant learn to read and write it as well. Learn English, get a job, send for your brother. The problem is he was never able to send for his brother because the family got wiped out by communism. And what family survived got wiped out by Nazism, which is another form of socialism. It's personal to me. It's personal to me regarding all the wonderful people I've met over the years, people I know who are from Cuba, who lost everything in the revolution overnight. It's personal to me because of friends of mine who have come from other totalitarian countries. I was in Bulgaria last year doing some speaking there. And my host was a wonderful guy, and he's taking me around Bulgaria, and he's just showing me all of these communist apartment buildings, which is the ugliest buildings you've ever seen in your life, which have been now retrofitted to, you know, house other people and, you know, the free people. But back in communism, this is where you lived for free. Oh, they spread the wealth around. Everybody lives for free, rent's free, don't have to pay for utilities. But my friend told me the problem is the elevators never worked. The heating was turned off in the winter. Oh, but everybody was equal. Everybody had jobs they hated. And then there were the elite who had everything they needed. This is where they want to go in net zero. I'm convinced. Net zero, it's never going to work. It could work, I suppose, if you went and included nuclear. But the environmentalists don't like nuclear either. So it is personal for me. And I do get choked up when I just talk about it. But this whole idea of social equity, I mean, Marx would just be so pleased with all of this. Here's what the Democratic Socialists of America say. This is just right from their website. They say securing an environmentally sustainable production system will require fundamental political and social change on every scale, from household to planet. It's what Al Gore once referred to as a wrenching transformation of society. This is what they want to do in the name of the environment. So we can talk a little bit about all of these plans that involve net zero and this big push to go into electric vehicles. And I just want to say this, if you own an EV, you have every right to do so. And if I hope that EV makes you happy, because actually, quite frankly, they're luxurious vehicles, some of them, and they're incredibly fast. I love fast cars. I've got a very fast car that I just love the heck out of. And I've also got my 2002 Dodge Ram that I probably actually love more. But if you want to have any kind of car, that's your right. And if you want to have a fast Tesla that does 0 to 60 in like 3 seconds, that's your prerogative. Please don't tell me how green it is. I don't want to hear that. Because I go into a lot of the specifics on the carbon footprint that's generated by manufacturing an electric vehicle. And it's larger than a comparative, you know, gas-powered vehicle. Carbon footprint's huge. If you drive an average of 14,000 miles a year and you have your average EV, charging that thing on a regular basis uses as much electricity as half your household does during the course of a month. So they suck up energy. Generally speaking, in the United States of America, that energy is coming from natural gas. It's not coming from solar and wind. It's coming from natural gas. So don't tell me how green it is, but I can say this about the batteries. And I'm not sure, Tom, if you've had any guests talk about the batteries. But
bad, yeah.
Okay, good. I'll need to sort out those particular discussions. because I'd love to hear what some of your people have said on them. But I do know this. This is from a paper I found, The Hazards of Electric Car Batteries and Their Recycling. By 2025, at the current rate, 11 million tons of waste lithium-ion batteries will flood our market. There's no system to deal with them. People are working hard on figuring out ways to recycle them, but there's nothing in the mix readily available yet. If the discarded batteries cannot be effectively disposed of, it will cause huge damage to the environment and humans. When the battery is damaged, it will generate a lot of heat and cause a fire. In addition to humans, waste batteries may have many potential hazards, and high concentrations of lithium can cause great harm to the human nervous system and endocrine system. I have a friend who works at the Tesla battery plant outside of Reno, and he's a project manager for their facility. He has nothing to do with making batteries. He's a facilities guy, and he works for a big construction company. But he has told me, and I've had this verified by others, that there are all these freight cars just parked all around Tesla's huge property. I think it's the biggest warehouse in the world, but there are all these freight cars filled with used Teslas. There's no market for a used Tesla. Once the battery dims, no one wants the car any longer, and no one wants to do with the batteries. So we've got all these batteries stacked up. I know for a fact that fire departments have special training now for dealing with those with battery fires because they're just so dangerous. So again, you may love your EV, and maybe there's a place for them in our world, but just don't tell me that these things are green and environmentally sound, because there are some definite issues here, without question. Net zero's footprint. This comes from Princeton University, and I break this down in Climate Cult. If net zero is accomplished without using nuclear, if we just go to solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, et cetera, we'll need 250 million acres of wind farms. That's equivalent to the states of Nebraska, Missouri, Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Illinois. That's how big it is. That's five states filled with wind turbines. Solar would be 17.5 million acres. That's about half of Indiana. So that's what they say it looks like. This, Tom, you'll get a kick out of this. This is a meme I had on my Twitter feed, which is debate me, Al Gore. this is what a net zero grid would look like in winter. I mean, they're actually de-icing this wind turbine. They're going to de-ice the wind turbine. So that's where all the oil jobs are going to go. Guys are going to be hanging out of helicopters, de-icing wind turbines, and I guess also taking ice scrapers to solar panels. This is so stupid. So that's going to be all the great jobs, all the great jobs we had in the oil industry. All you guys who love your job, right? This is now what you're going to be doing in the net zero world. This is so but the other thing, Tom, I talk about, and I wanted to be very careful here because I wanted to do this as soundly as possible for the sake of credibility and the sake of just having the facts. A lot of people are quick to talk about geoengineering and solar engineering. And so I devote a large portion of the book to this particular topic because people are very interested. They want to know, is this for real? Is this what's going on? And I did it without even talking about contrails. Because the fact of the matter is, there's so much primary source material available to let you know that it's been around for a long time, and it was started in the United States. And the story is actually, I find the story fascinating. And if I could here, just go to that. This was the president's, we started in World War II doing this, and it was to de-ice planes. And in the process of learning how to de-ice planes, they realized, wow, if you seed the atmosphere with dry ice, you know, frozen carbon dioxide, you can make weather. This is incredible. But in 1953, the president said this: we need to make a complete study, an evaluation of public and private experiments in weather control for the purpose of determining the next extent which the United States should experiment with, engage in, or regulate activities designed to control the weather. So we've been doing this for quite some time. And now we have, as we've been doing this for some time, now we have a situation where there are think tanks all over the country. Harvard has a big program where they're researching how to modify the weather and even more significantly, modify the stratosphere. You know, there's no weather in the stratosphere. So now they want to create weather in the stratosphere, thinking that the clouds are going to reflect back radiation and they could cool the overall atmosphere. I believe I mentioned this in Climate Call. I believe there are 50 countries working on various forms of geoengineering right now, including solar geoengineering. I know that China employs, and they're actively doing weather modification in China because the skies get so cruddy from the coal plants that they're, the dirty coal plants that they use there. No one seems to care about that. We have clean coal plants here. They have dirty ones there. Nobody cares. But they keep promising us they're going to go to net zero. But the coal plants they have there are so filthy that the skies in the big cities just get totally crudded up. And then they seed the clouds, create rain, and wash them out. That's just a regular thing they do there. What I find amazing is no one will admit they're doing all this study on solar geoengineering, and no one will admit to whether or not we're actually doing it. I just can't believe that all of these thinkers would be happy with whiteboards and computer models. You would think they would want to try it, but no one will admit to trying it. And one of the things I wonder, I know there are over a million people with top secret clearances in the United States of America. Maybe that's why they won't tell us. I don't know. But I just find that part of it fascinating. And I also find it fascinating that when you go to some of the very liberal think tanks, like the Brookings administration or the Brookings Institute, excuse me, like when you go to the, oops, oh, hold on. Okay, there we go. Like the Brookings Institute. When you go to their website, this is what they say about geoengineering and even solar engineering. As worsening climate conditions are likely to generate continued worldwide interest in geoengineering deployment, the world cannot afford to wait until an emergency arrives if it hopes to navigate increasingly complicated climate and geoengineering scenarios. Now, to me, that's frightening. They're saying, we just can't wait. We got to do this. We have to do this. Now, you want to screw up the climate? Maybe that's the ultimate way to do so. Start this solar geoengineering. Tom, that frightens me. I don't know what that could entail. And I don't know what their real plan is in doing this. But those are some of the runs and hits from Climate Cult. I also have a bunch of recommendations that I hope a new administration might employ. Because at the end of the day, we've got to reverse these crazy, unfounded environmental laws. We've got right now, in terms of net zero, there is the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. Their mission is to transition America to net zero. And the Biden administration has instituted all of these policies. We're just going hell-bent for leather towards this particular direction. And that world is not one in which I want to live. I mean, I've heard all the stories from my friends who formerly lived in the Soviet Union, and it was hell on earth. Oh, it's supposed to be the new man, the new Soviet man, and everyone was going to be equal. But I know there have been many leaders who have said this over the years. He who controls energy controls the people. And that's what I believe they want to do with all of this. They want to control our energy. They want to keep us under control. I mean, that's what the smart grid is, the smart meter is all about that may be attached to your home. I go into source documents in Climate Cult explaining all of that, as I did back in Climate Gate. This is a feature of your home that's designed to have remote controllability from an outside party. They can limit your use of the energy if they so choose. And I think that's where we're going. And that's why we need to be informed and be ready to be activated and get great people in office. But I will just say this, Tom, in closing, and then I thank you for all this time. It's just been really super awesome. I feel like a star being on your on your program. This is great. But I say this at the end of the book. For those caught in the web of the climate change agenda, the slogan, everyone belongs to everyone else, that's from Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Everyone belongs to everyone else. That slogan is their hope and dream. I mean, these people that are caught up in this climate agenda and innocently caught up into it, especially the younger generation. You know, the younger millennials, Gen X, Gen Z, these are some of the most compassionate people ever. So they're so easily drawn into this. But in reality, if the agenda is allowed to succeed, everyone will be subject to everyone else in the elite class. And global tyranny will reign. And this was another part as I was reading the transcript for the audio portion of the book where I just broke. In the works of science fiction, the world is often presented as being scientifically logical. In fantasy novels and films, it's mostly depicted as supernatural. But the real-life climate change world is scientifically illogical and demonically, in my opinion, demonically supernatural. The climate change cult and those who control it are not a conspiracy theory. They're part of an open, avowed, well-planned scheme that may read like fantasy, but in reality is absolutely deadly to every human being in the entire world. Their marketing slogan spells exactly what their goal is. This is from the World Economic Forum, who in 2019 became the official partner of the United Nations. I've got the document. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy. So now maybe you'll understand a little better my anger expressed in the opening page of this chapter. And if you find yourself feeling the same way, I hope you can join me in heeding my own advice. Be angry, but don't sin. And certainly don't remain silent about what you've read. So it's my great hope. You know, there have been so many people, and you've interviewed so many of them. There have been so many people that have written some excellent books, just totally debunking global warming and climate change. And there's new information coming out all the time. And you've been your finger's been on the pulse of this, Tom. And I'm so glad for you to be there. We need these voices. But I want to just unpack this on a different level because I want people maybe to see for the first time, wow, I've been sold a bill of goods. I don't like where this is headed. Or maybe you really do believe that there is human-caused global warming, and then you look at the rest of the agenda and say, well, but I don't believe it. I don't believe that. I don't want these other things to take place. I kind of like my freedom. So maybe this will turn a few heads, and maybe this will cause people to just see things differently and aright, wake some minds up, and pull some people out of the cult. I mean, that's my greatest hope, Tom. That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah, two more months till the book comes out, right? End of May 28th or so? Yeah.
Yes, and it's available for pre-order right now, and the publisher is Post Hill Press. They have a lot of great authors, and I'm just so pleased to be a part of their group. And what they've done is they've got a discounted price for the pre-sale. So if you purchase the book now for $18.90, you're guaranteed that price through May 28th when the book finally comes out. But I highly encourage, pre-sales are very good because it helps with publicity and distribution. So if we want to get the word out, that kind of stuff in the publishing world is a big deal. So I just appreciate the opportunity to be here, Tom, and I hope that there'll be another opportunity down the line as things pick up. And I want to encourage you, you know, as a fellow podcaster, broadcaster, and a guy who's just seeking the truth, keep doing what you're doing, man. It's very important. You have an important voice. You've created a great platform, and a lot of people are well served by the incredible minds that you're able to bring forward. I'm nothing compared to some of these super geniuses you have on your program, but I thank you for all of that.
So, do you have time for a few more questions here before we
wrap man, up? Yes.
So I'm just looking here in your 2010 book, Climate Gate, there's a headline that says, Marx's worst nightmare, America. Do you still agree with that America is the holdout, or they're the ones that are going to not allow this to happen?
You know, it's really interesting. I actually wrote that in 2009. The book came out in 2010. So much has changed since then. The political dynamic has changed since then. There are elements within our government that have become increasing, that have increased in number since then. And what do I mean by that? Well, a lot of people use the term deep state. Who is the deep state? The deep state are unelected bureaucrats that get behind the scenes. The deep state are stakeholders. These are, you know, nonprofits, a lot of nonprofit groups that happen to be environmental organizations. Those are the stakeholders. Those are part of the deep state. And the deep state is also lobbyists. There are a lot of people who are lobbyists who say, man, I represent the solar industry. Heck yes, we want to go net zero. I represent wind turbines. You're darn right, we want to go. So when the laws in this country are written, so now we have more of those people than ever. So I think we've started to veer close. Marx might be looking back now saying, all right, I like what I'm seeing. This is going just right since Sussman wrote that book in 2010. But what we have now are laws being written in Congress, like the Inflation Reduction Act. Okay, that sounds so wonderful. Yeah, well, inflation's terrible. We need to do something about that. Well, there are hundreds of billions of dollars earmarked for the climate agenda in the Inflation Reduction Act. Well, how did that happen? How do these people vote on this? They don't have time to read a 2,000-page bill. The bill wasn't written by any of those elected officials. It was written by lobbyists, stakeholders, and bureaucrats. So much has transpired since that time. That's why there was a need for the update to this book. And in 2010, I was positive. I mean, I was very positive that we would turn the ship around. It's 2024, and I'm becoming very disheartened. Very disheartened. No, and that's why I just thought I am one man. I got to do something.
Yeah, I agree with you that the deep state is a big threat to all of us. But which politicians in the U.S. are the biggest threat to the deep state?
I'm thinking of one guy. I do a radio program weekly in Sedona, Arizona. It's called Straight Talk. And straighttalksedona.com is the website if you're interested in looking at past episodes. And perhaps you will, because there's a congressman I interview. He's a first-term congressman. His name is Eli Crane. Most people have never heard of Eli Crane. He's a former combat Navy SEAL, 13 deployments into combat zones. This guy has seen the communist totalitarian enemy up close and personal. And he's a very strategic thinker. And sometimes he's very disheartened by what he sees in the U.S. Congress. And he's not been a fan of some of the more mainstream politicians, even on the Republican side of the aisle. But there are a few people like him that are driving this whole idea of getting us back to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as the founders intended. So Eli Crane is one congressman that I really stand behind. And there are others in the House Freedom Caucus that I think really have their acts together as well. But there are a lot of others who are just, you know, they're mainstay politicians, and they're a part of the problem. And they're in the Republican Party as well. And we need more of these young bucks to get in there and shake things up. People who see what time it is, they're not afraid to talk about it. So I like that Eli Crane guy a lot. And there are some others as well, but he to me is like, he's the heart and soul of this new generation of congressional membership.
So if I heard you right, you've been called a denier as far back as 1996. So you go way back here. You were looking into this way before Steve McIntyre was, et cetera. In the whole big picture, how are things going in 2024 compared to way back when?
Well, I'm excited because I think that we have a situation. I'm just looking at some notes to see if I can find something from the book that works for this. But there's so much new information that has come forward. Well, first of all, you have a guy like John Clauser, Nobel recipient in physics, as I mentioned earlier. Does it get any brighter than that when that guy comes in and says, okay, this whole thing is a hoax? Another great example would be, and I know he's older, but Dr. Neil Frank, who endorsed Climate Cult, I was so thrilled to get his endorsement. you know, this guy was, he remains the top hurricane expert in the world. He's the professor emeritus of hurricanes, and he's sharp as a tack even to this day. I interviewed him recently. Love him. And he said to the Washington Post in 2006, it's a hoax. So we're getting more and more people like that coming forward and digging into the details and looking at the information and realizing that the modifications to, for example, even the satellite record has been modified. And now finally we're realizing those modifications were not consistent with reality. So we're seeing all of this information coming forward, and I find it to be very exciting, refreshing, emboldening, and it's just proving for those who have been deniers and those who have been skeptics that, man, we've been on the right track all along. So I think there's a need for more books. There's a need for more research, and there's a need for more people stepping into the fray and willing to take the heat for it.
All right. Any other points you'd like to make before we go ahead and finish this one up?
Well, I just I really believe that we have a crisis on our hands. And I really believe that if we don't, that we're being hit from so many different sides right now. The climate agenda is a big one, but we're being hit by so many sides that are trying to alter the American culture and are trying to bring forth a new dynamic of morality that we've never seen before. And what we're seeing in Washington, D.C. and in many state capitals is so subversive and so diabolical. You know, again, I'm just one guy. I'm trying to do my part in one particular specific area. But I mentioned this at the very end of the book in the afterword. You know, I say, listen, if we're going to really change this nation, I think we need something that changed this nation before it became a nation. And that was in the 1700s, where there was this great spiritual awakening that took place. And had that not occurred, it would not have given the people the courage to go up and face the biggest empire of all time, the British Empire. So there was this spiritual awakening that led to an emboldening of the personal spirits of the people of America who said, okay, we got to stop this. And they took a great gamble and they fought the biggest empire on the planet and they won. And they won and lived to fight another day. And that fight was going to be over a constitution. And we put that together and it was heralded in life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. So there is hope. There is hope. But it's going to take great effort. And so that's my prayer, and that's my hope and my wish for America and for all of those who are watching this podcast today.
So that awakening you're talking about in the 1700s, that was only a small percentage of Americans at first, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I would say that really it was probably only, I've read that it was as many as 25 or 30% of the people. But they became such an influencing force, especially amongst the founders. So many of the founders were cut from that cloth, and many of the founders were actually pastors and ministers in their own churches. So they were able to speak eloquently on these particular topics and really move the needle for people to get in the fray and be willing to risk their life, their liberty, and their pursuit of happiness. In fact, I think if I don't do it in ClimateGate, I do it in Eco-Tyranny. I dedicate the last portion of the book to our founders who did just that. They were willing to risk everything. And some of them died broke. Rich people that were attacked so viciously once they signed that Declaration of Independence, their houses ransacked, their farms seized, livestock destroyed, wives murdered. They lost everything. So we need to be willing to step up and take some risks if we want to bring this country back to center.
All right. Very good. Thank you for being on the podcast, Brian Sussman. Hope to have you back on again later.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks.